Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Last time we covered the first half of the 20th century, and we're going to press on here into the 1950s and beyond, not in some quest for interstellar transport, but rather to consider the motorways. And of course, this is the period in which other British transport systems hit crisis, most obviously with the Beeching Report on the Railways in the 1960s, but other road uses, whether the trolley bus or the tram, also hit problems. The number of 1,000 million passenger miles by rail, that well-known statistic we all wheeled, fell from 24.2 in 1952 to 20.5 in 1976. May not sound too great, a fall of that type, which is about 20%, but it is, of course, during a period of rising prosperity and population. And at the same time, for bus or coach, it went from 50.3 in 1952 to 32.9 in 1976. But in contrast, the number of 1,000 million passenger miles by car, taxi and motorcycle rose from 33.6 in 1952, so that's less than bus or coach, to 215 in 1976. So in other words, that's more than 10 times that for rail, and to 352.9 in 1990, at a time when the rail one was 25.5. So the figures, the transport had completely changed. Car ownership indeed was seen as a success. Margaret Thatcher, the Conservative Prime Minister from 1979 to 1990, who would probably be turning over in her grave at each of the Conservative Prime Ministers since 2010, suggested that a 26-year-old man who was a bus passenger could see himself as a failure. Probably true in terms of relative wealth and aspiration, but certainly not what something that a prime minister would have thought it expedient to say 50 years earlier. John Prescott, the Labour deputy prime minister from 1997 to 2007, claimed the car was the most democratic invention of the century, which is presumably why he had two Jaguars. Although he also claimed that more people would be using public transport and driving their cars less, which showed that he knew how to suck up to the Labour transport unions. Certainly, passenger transport overwhelmingly switched to car in our period, while road freight became more competitive to rail due to the relaxation of weight limits for lorries and due also the construction of motorways. Now, there was, of course, other transport systems, but canals languished. Air posed scant competition. 1970, 0.5% of passenger miles were on domestic flights, and that was despite a tenfold increase from 1951. So I think it's very fair to say that what we ought to be looking at is really the roads, and as I said, all more particularly the cars. The creation of the motorway system provided a new set of links around the country with nodes, services, issues and problems and conversational gambits or lack of them accordingly. The development was part of an international change, one seen in particular both in continental Europe, notably with the German Autobahn and the Italian Autostrada, but also with the establishment in America of the interstate system, also a development like the British motorways from the 1950s, and one linked to a presentation of cars as democratic. The funding in each case was state. In Britain, there were not the toll charges seen in some continental states, notably France and Italy. Instead, although there was no fixed allocation of the income, motorways were in effect paid by the contribution made by road users through motor vehicle license taxation and petrol duty. Both were considerable, and of course, the aggregate score and value to the Treasury increased because of the number of cars. And this established a funding challenge today, because the use of electric cars will mean there's going to be a little pressure on petrol duty, not least as government takes measures in order to incentivize electric cars. Indeed, you might say, if you wish to be facetious, you might say that electric cars are the equivalent of getting people to give up smoking, that smoking was jolly good for the national expenditure on pensions, etc., because it killed people. And well, it didn't kill people, but it led to higher death rates. And electric and petrol cars, of course, led to more duty into the treasury to pay, I suppose, also for the National Health Service. The motorways were also seen as a way to help the economy, both by facilitating freight movements, which greatly relied on predictable, steady speed journeys, and those steady speed journeys were much more easy by motorway, or at least the early days of motorway, and by encouraging the car industry. The greater prominence of this compared to that of railway-linked manufacture was very important to the political economy of transport in Britain. Moreover, unlike with the established earlier establishment of railway works, which were essentially at the behest of the rail companies, car manufacturing became, notably from the 1960s, an aspect of regional policy, with the location of plants encouraged and subsidised on Merseyside and in central Scotland, places like Linwood and Bathgate, and later with the Nissan works at Sunderland. Such measures and the more general investment and employment bound up in car and lorry manufacturing and in associated companies made it difficult at the governmental level to oppose calls for the development of the road infrastructure. And this was the case for all political parties. Now, you know, people sometimes criticise Marples, the Minister of Transport, and argue that the beaching proposals very much were linked to the road construction interests of the Conservatives, which may well have been true. But of course, Labour was pretty much the same. Labour was very close to road use and car manufacturing unions, particularly to the Transport and General Workers Union. Moreover, the car factories were located in Labour-supporting areas and not in their Conservative counterparts, which was an important aspect of the regional politics of transport. I mean, bluntly, the rail unions looked to Labour, but actually they couldn't bring Labour the benefit that it could get by cosying up to road. Motorways were regarded as aspects of a modernisation that was also pursued through civil nuclear power, corporatist industrial policies, and the attempts to join the European Economic Union, all of which were very much associated with the Macmillan government of 1957 to 1963. Pump priming investment, such as motorways, was praised as an economic, social, and regional benefit, as a rather different form of benefit. Allegedly, gangland victims, particularly from London, were buried in the concrete bridges along the M1. I have no idea whether that was true. It was certainly an urban tale oft repeated. The first motorway opened, the 8 Mile Preston Bypass, later part of the M6, was opened in December 1958 by Macmillan. And it's very symptomatic that the Prime Minister should be wheeled out to open an 8 Mile bypass around Preston. And this was rapidly followed by the M1 from St Albans to Rugby, which was then 50 miles compared to the present 200 miles of the M1. This was a tourist attraction for a while. Indeed, I can remember being taken to go and see it. Modern drivers are amazed by photographs and films showing how few vehicles were on the motorway. There was no speed limit until 1965, when one was introduced at 70 miles an hour. And the first motorway service station, that centrepiece of British conversation for travellers, was opened at Newport Pagnell in 1960. The motorway system was to spread rapidly over succeeding decades, in part in order to provide what was portrayed as comprehensive cover, and in part to deal with unexpected heavy usage, not least for the M1, which started to crumble within 3 years and not as envisaged 20. By 1969, 1,000 miles of motorway were complete, By 1980, over half the population was within 25 miles of a motorway. And by 1990, there were 1,919 miles of motorway, including in 1986, the 118-mile round London M25, which cost £909 million and compared to the HS2 was a bargain. Car use increased significantly. Although in the 1950s, cars were still essentially a middle-class means of transport and were advertised accordingly, in the 1960s, much of the working class bought them, a process greatly eased by the rise in average wage rates and by higher purchase systems, and one encouraged by the movement from inner cities to new housing estates where parking was more plentiful. The idea of putting your car on your drive or your bit of the pavement outside your house became one that spread rapidly around the social system. Now, there were still, however, major differences in when people from different classes or social groups acquired cars. So in Birmingham, for example, as Richard Vinen's recent history shows, in 1972, only 8% of women in council houses had driving licences. Very different, obviously, in the middle-class suburbs. Women in Birmingham had to negotiate buses, escalators and pedestrian bridges, whereas in contrast, the affluent knew little about public transport. Indeed, in 1975, most members of Birmingham Council's Transport Committee had not used public transport in the previous 4 months, which was personally prudent, though politically unwise. The private ownership of cars in the country increased fivefold between 1950 and 1970, a rate that greatly outperformed that of commercial vehicles, which instead doubled, while that of buses and coaches essentially remained constant. Large long-distance road haulage had been largely denationalised by the Conservatives in 1953, although the fact of the matter was there was a degree interest in subsequent renationalisation by Labour, notably with the Transport Act of 1968 at the behest of the Transport and General Workers Union, and this discouraged investment in that industry. By 1966, half of all British households owned one or more cars, which reflected both wider ownership, but also in a way its continued concentration in part of the social system, which is exactly as what you would expect. I mean, the same thing was true of house ownership. The cheap price of petrol in the 1960s encouraged the adoption of cars. Petrol prices didn't really go up significantly until the oil shock of the early 70s, 1973. In contrast, as I've mentioned, other forms of transport declined. Whereas in 1952, cyclists were responsible for more than 10% of all British passenger miles, in 1970, the percentage was only one. For buses and coaches, the percentages moved from 42 to 15, for motorcycles from 3 to 1. Between 1975 and 1993, the number of those qualified to drive rose by 52%, so that two-thirds of those aged 17 and over were qualified, had driving licences. These, were, of course, were petrol-driven vehicles. In 1966, it's true that developments in lightweight battery-powered cars led to much interest, notably from the UK Electricity Council, but a lack of orders and problems with battery charging ensured that no manufacturers committed to them. The limits on work time for lorry and bus drivers and the economic significance of freight encouraged measures to speed traffic, notably by improving roads. It was argued that this would be economically beneficial. It's interesting that now, when the concerns are much more to do with the environment, the concern is to slow transport, which again is an interesting thing. I mean, in one respect, it reflects the valorization of life as opposed to all other criteria, which you saw, I suppose, in the reaction to COVID. On the other hand, it reflects, I suppose you might argue, an astonishing degree of economic naivety. Being delayed hit the efficiency of lorries, which otherwise had considerably increased due to their larger permitted length. such that by the early 70s, lorries could be called HGVs, or ticks for articulated lorries and juggernauts. Indeed, the ton miles carried by lorry rose 343% in the period 1958 to 1986. And you might argue that that was one of the factors that made it possible to circumvent rail strikes. And indeed, when the rail union supported the miners in the National Union of Miner dispute against the Mrs. Thatcher government, that was made much less serious by the extent of the freight system covered by road. As ever, transport had a political dimension, and this, of course, will remain the case in the next government. A different form of freight was the long-established caravan, which had preceded motor transport but became much more common from the 1950s with less expensive assembly line mass-produced caravans. The use of lighter materials helped, and as the price fell, the number of households using caravans rose from 2 million in 1955 to 4.5 million in 1967, and they were a frequent sight on major British roads. The romance of the road now seems very distant, but at the time there was considerable enthusiasm for motorways and relatively few protests. Indeed, Barbara Castle, Labour's determined Minister of Transport from 1965 to 68, described sites such as the Almondsbury motorway interchange of the M4 and M5, still a difficult and, in my view, hazardous interchange, as, quote, the cathedrals of the modern world, which I think tells you very much about Barbara Castle and about the ethos of the Labour government of that period. Both parties backed the motorways, the Conservatives implementing policies for trunk roads developed by Labour in the late 1940s. In 1958, indeed, motorways had been redefined as, quote, limited access dual carriageway road with grade separation, completely fenced in, normally with hard shoulders, for the exclusive use of prescribed classes of motor vehicles, which meant that not everybody could be on them. The impact of major roads on established sites was amply displayed with National Trust properties. Those of you who know your literature will know that at the end of Brideshead Revisited, The Pain to a Past England by Evelyn Waugh, there's a reference on how the grounds of Brideshead had been bashed around by the need of motor trucks for the army during World War II. Well, that was as nothing as compared to what was about to happen. The M1 now speeds past Hardwick Hall. The M54 past Moseley Old Hall. The six-lane Plimpton bypass was cut through the park at Saltram in 1970, largely obliterating the 18th century carriage drive. The M4 was driven through the Austerley estate in 1965, the M5 through the Killerton estate, although the Exeter Northern bypass scheme linked to the M5 was not pursued. Within cities, and here we're not so much talking about motorways, there were also abrupt changes, and ones that were quite profound, and more profound in a way, I would argue, than rail, because, as you may know, major roads are much wider than major railways. Thus, Birmingham's Inner Ring Road was built between 1957 and 1971, while Wolverhampton's Ring Road was open in stages between 1961 and 1986, clearing away established landmarks and residential districts. And I have to say, you know, with the best will in the world, the centre of Wolverhampton does not look marvellous at the moment. Carlisle's Ring Road opened in 1974, cut the castle off from the city, and was followed by the replacement of a long-established area by a shopping centre. Pressure for bypasses grew, and the towns that gained them, as with Honiton in 1966 or Ashburton, became far more attractive places to live than those such as Crediton that don't have them. Also in Devon, the A30 bypassed Okehampton, the A38 bypassed Ivy Bridge before passing north of the centre of Plymouth and over the new Tamar Bridge. As a result, the route to the southwest, which had hitherto been very slow, became less slow, sometimes even swifter. In turn, however, there were new bottlenecks. To the east, the A303 was improved, parts becoming dual carriageway, while some towns, including Ilminster, were bypassed. However, where the road was not dualed, there were, in other words, dual carriageways, there were major issues, notably for the 303 across the Blackdown Hills and near Stonehenge. In each case, other policy concerns and constraints, notably landscape and heritage, clashed with that of ease of transport, a clash that has lasted in those two cases to the present. So also with the A35 west across southern Dorset to Honiton. Dualed, as near Axminster, which was bypassed, as was Bridport, it sped along, but that was not hot possible in the hills between there and Honiton. Further east, near Charmouth, greater traffic flow on the A35 made village life unpleasant, leading to local activism. What happens there is that locals, who are very unhappy about this, continually press the pedestrian crossing lights in order to stop the traffic. The MP for West Dorset from 1997 to 2019, Oliver Letwin, told me that calls for village bypasses set villagers against those who lived in more rural settings through which these would be built. And as he very eloquently observed, there was absolutely no way to satisfy everybody. Now, the 1980 Highways Act maintained the pre-existing local authority responsibility for highways, but where there was provision, it didn't always work, in part due to rising demand. Some ring roads and bypasses were badly planned and quickly became engulfed by the towns in question, for example, the Newbury Ring Road. Across the country, for the sake of speed and safety, roundabouts and junctions along trunk roads, such as the A1, were replaced by slip roads. Demand more generally for road use, notably motorway use, rapidly increased. So in Cambridgeshire, between 1981 and 1995, traffic on the mostly new A14 and on the totally new M11 increased by close to 300%. Whereas in the same period, it grew there by over 100% on the older established A1. Seen as a public service, motorways were toll-free, although there were to be exceptions, notably tolls on the 27.6-mile M6 toll road, which you don't want to get into by mistake, as I once did, which was finished in 2002, on the Dartford crossing on the M25 and on major bridges. There were very many environmental consequences for roads. Cities that in the 1960s enjoyed far more sunshine hours from the clearer atmosphere after the declaration of smokeless zones subsequently noted a decline as a result of car exhaust. Concern about the health consequences developed and encouraged a marked increase in regulatory intensity in the cities, not necessarily, though, easing the problems. More immediately, rabbits, hedgehogs, badgers, deer, birds, toads were killed in large numbers each year on the roads. And areas of rural calm became less often less common. For example, the extension of the M40 from Oxford to Birmingham, proposed in 1972 to take pressure off the M1 on the London West Midlands route, was opened in 1991 after major battles over the route across Otmore, which had been an area of rural calm, and certainly isn't now. Nearby Banbury, as a result, became a major distribution centre, making use of the M40 with, for example, a large Amazon depot. At the neighbourhood level, major routes became obstacles in the second half of the 20th century, as high streets were turned into through routes, as in London's South Circular, which is dire for traffic and dire for pedestrians. With roads busier and the traffic faster, they became barriers for pedestrians, the number of whom killed rose by a third between 1950 and 1969, and cycling became more difficult. In response, Zebra crossings were pushed from 1951, and lollipop ladies to aid pedestrians, especially children, to cross roads from 1954. Death rates among drivers were tackled with speed limits, breathalyzers, and seat belts, which eventually became compulsory, as indeed they did for passengers. In turn, the danger of existing roads encouraged the building of new through routes unrelated to the existing neighbourhoods, as in Glasgow in the 1970s, as with the East Central Motorway in Newcastle in the early 70s, which when I lived there, I described as having been designed with the RVI in mind, the Royal Victoria Infirmary, the hospital, in order to make sure that business was there was very high, and also Newcastle's Western Bypass in 1990. In her novel A Certain Justice, published in 1997, the novelist P.D. James, a very sound and fine observer of social and other change, observed of the building of Westway in the late 60s in London, "Soon there would be nothing but tarmac and the ceaseless roar and screech of traffic thundering westward out of London. In time, even memory would be powerless to conjure up what once had been." Now it's a farce, Westway. The traffic has a speed limit on it, so having wrecked the environment, the traffic crawls along. I was born in Edgware, north of the A41, which was domesticated as the Watford Way, but was the A41, and the journey to school involved crossing this en route to Edgware tube station. This was done at the traffic lights at the junction with Edgware Lane, although traffic flow could be so low when I was growing up that it was possible to walk across the A41 at other places. Cars could leave the northward side of Edgware Lane at the lights and turn either way into the A41. Subsequently, the pattern there was to be one of continual restriction, with cars stopped from turning right. Later, the pedestrian crossing was removed at the junction, and barriers along the A41 made earlier crossing impossible. Now there's a high bridge to cross, one that's impossible for prams or the infirm and inconvenient for the fit. I think, you know, I don't live there anymore, but I think that that's an apt image to me of the, as it were, mixed blessings. And, you know, it just doesn't have to just be somebody who lived in outer London who can think that. If you're Welsh, you will know that the difficulties of travelling from North and Wales to South Wales, vice versa, remain very difficult. In 1941, at the annual general meeting of the National Industrial Council of Wales and Monmouthshire, whose papers I once looked at in the National Archives, Councillor G.O. Williams of Flintshire County Council emphasised that post-war reconstruction should need to address the difficulties of travelling from North Wales. I think it's fair to say that North Wales to South Wales and vice versa are still very difficult. The improvement in the motorways and other road and rail links have brought Cardiff closer to Bristol and London, but not to Bangor. Bangor is closer, obviously, to Liverpool, and Aberystwyth is beyond where time forgot. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, the car system had its disadvantages, even for those people who wished to be its advocate. Of course, the car system was also ironically used by all sorts of individuals. For example, the so-called flying pickets, people determined to mess up the life of others, of 1978-9 and 1984-5, were so committed to the public system sector that they, of course, went by road when they were trying to block workers. In practice, reliance on public sector transport itself was repeatedly undermined by strike action, as indeed remains the case today. Somewhat differently, there have been many other problems for the late 20th century. We're going to go on to the 21st century next time. But among other things to think about were the issues of parking. The greater use of cars meant greater pressure on parking, which led to contention over land use, visual amenity, capacity charges, and things like charges for parking at hospitals became a focus of particular contention and political promises. In practice, charges appeared to be a way to deal with serious demand pressures and to tackle the flow of traffic into the urban areas. But then at the time, there were real questions about the availability of parking for staff and its impact on staff safety. Meanwhile, as earlier with rail, the language changed to take on board the use of cars, with motorway service stations, breathalyzers, seat belts, contraflows, motorway madness, and flying pickets, all entering the language as an aspect of the age of the motor car. Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Jeremy. I'm going to ask about motorways in a moment, but just a quick question on a subject you touched on early on, which is that of the Labour Party's focus on trying to nationalise or renationalise road freight. What was the thinking for this idea? Was it just, we've nationalised the airline, we've nationalised the railways, we should nationalise rail freight? Or was there a socialist argument which has now been kind of lost to time? No one, I think, argues for it now, that it was necessary for the state to control road freight.
Well, I think it's fair to say that at that stage, the state was, under Labour, was extraordinarily ambitious for directing the commanding heights of the economy and just about everything else. So I don't think they would have seen that as in any way incompatible. The idea was there should be a united transport strategy which should include rail and road freight, and indeed canals, which were also under state control, and domestic air services. So, I mean, I think you could say that there was very much almost the only thing that wasn't was really private cars. And in a way, they were under state regulation with state licensing of cars and state taxation on petrol.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more about the main theme of what you've just been discussing, which is the motorway. When Britain started laying out its motorways, was it ahead of Europe in this? Obviously, the famous German autobahns of the 1930s. But that aside, were we in tandem with similar developments in Western Europe? Were we behind the United States in this? Or was everyone doing it at roughly the same time?
Everybody was doing it at roughly the same time. I mean, England, of course, is much more crowded in terms of population. France, the United States, Italy, West Germany. And I think that had practical difficulties. One of the things that's worth bringing out, which is what I was trying to do, was that it had become a bipartisan policy in Britain, which was ironic given Labour's stance in the late 40s of state control. And it reminds me of a talk I once heard by Anthony Wedgwood Benn, Tony Benn, as he liked to call himself, but who argued that the true options for socialism in Britain ended when commercial television was founded in the mid-1950s. Well, of course, I suppose, I mean, that's a viewpoint. I suppose you could take it slightly differently and say, actually, given that Labour were, thankfully, because I think it would have been absolutely farcical if Labour had allocated car licences, but given that Labour wasn't going to control private ownership of cars and that private ownership was going to shoot up, what that did was destabilized the Labour position on transport, because, as I've mentioned, despite the amount of money they were pushing into other areas, it was the private sector that was overwhelmingly buoyant.
That's an interesting thought. I was wondering about the role that the development of the motorway had in terms of the centralization of government. So you have the Ministry of Transport, as it was then called during this period. You know, it's setting out its plans for motorways. Did they just use existing purchasing powers, or in what way was the role of local government in Britain reduced so that the men from the ministry could realise their grand plans?
Well, essentially, the Treasury financing was important not just to central government, but also, of course, to local government. So that in many senses, this is a Treasury-driven idea, and it's driven by, as I've mentioned, the notion that this is going to be very helpful for modern manufacturing, and in particular for greenfield manufacturing, by which I mean new site manufacturing. It's no accident, though, of course, to see that there is a political dimension. I lived for many years, I think 17, in the northeast of England. And anybody that lived then in County Durham was well aware that roads like the A1M very much reflected the way in which Labour was putting money into the road links of its industrial and other electoral fiefdoms.
Just one final question, if I may, and that's about the nature of bypasses. You mentioned your conversation with Oliver Letwin. Nowadays, there's very much a debate as to whether bypasses help or hinder market towns. The shopkeepers would say it's very bad for business. Others would say, well, it relieves unacceptable traffic pressure from the centre of town. In the 1960s and 70s, how well developed was this debate?
It was less well developed than is now. I think the general view was that a bypass would take away through traffic, but would not stop people coming into areas to shop. I mean, if you think about it, the key problem for people coming into shop was parking. And one of the joys of the 1960s and 70s was the concrete parking garage that was put up as part of developments, often linked to a bypass or ring road or other urban link road, so that shoppers should still be able to enjoy the urine-stained smell of their parking environment as they went on their way to Tesco's.
Well, that's a pungent point on which to end this podcast. Next episode, we'll take it through to the modern day, including the increasing movement against car usage. But for talking us through the golden age of the March of the Motorways, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Listeners may be interested to know that my History of America has just come out, so if they've got nothing else to do, they might enjoy reading it as they contemplate the background to no doubt a very dull and quiet American electoral cycle.
No doubt indeed. Many thanks, Jeremy.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.